Hello, Texas, America, and the world. This is Mark Dankos, America, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas, on the Ugly Truth Radio Network. We'd like to greet people in the United States, Great Britain, Ireland, Czechoslovakia, Switzerland, Spain, Canada, the Netherlands, Italy, and Lebanon that are already with us here on the broadcast this afternoon. And as many of you know, San Antonio is the Alamo City. It's Military Town USA, and last but not least, it's the Deus home of Mr. Christian Zionism, John Hagee of Cornerstone Church, whose wallet is home to an estimated $150 million in personal empire in exchange for the good pastor's dedication to the establishment of an Israeli-directed police state in the continental United States and the mass murder of Palestinians, Iranians, and other assorted indigenous peoples of the Middle East and Central Asia, all in the name of Jesus, of course. Or is it mammon? Our topic today is the Mujahideen-e Call terror organization, now being used by Israeli intelligence and the West in general. Our guest shortly to come up will be Dr. Paul Sheldon Foote of Cal State Fullerton and Anne Singleton of the UK, who herself is a past member of the Mujahideen-e Call. Before I bring them up, these are the lead stories. Story number one, the Rand Paul endorsement of Mitt Romney. See the Christian Science Monitor's commentary on this one, as well as what is posted at www.ronpaul.com. Folks, the Rand Paul endorsement of Mitt Romney makes Pat Buchanan's 1996 endorsement of Bob Dole and Jack Kent smell like Febreze fabric softener. Those of you listening to Mark Dankoff, Mark Glenn, and Michael Collins Piper on Rand Paul had advance warning. The American populist freedom, constitutional and libertarian movements have been had again. End of story. Our toll-free call-in number, by the way, is 866-730-7514. That's 866-730-7514. The access code is 285-645-POUND. That's 285-645-POUND. Those who wish to participate via Skype may do so by using freeconferencing.530-881-1300 as the Skype contact. That's freeconferencing.530-881-1300. After calling that contact, use the access code 179-164-POUND. That's access code 179-164-POUND. You can also go to the chat room, which is at www.theuglytruth.wordpress.com. Story number two, why Obama will free Jonathan Pollard. The president accepts the Israelis' infallibility doctrine. This is a point by Grant F. Smith at antiwar.com. Mr. Smith tells us that the U.S. Justice Department has released new files about convicted spy Jonathan Pollard's bid for presidential clemency. Pollard was sentenced to life in prison in 1987 after passing more than a million highly classified documents to Israel while working as an intelligence analyst for the U.S. Navy. Documents in the Freedom of Information Act response reference 32 pages of government agency deliberative communications and 7 pages of new communications between pardon attorney Ronald Rogers and Pollard's legal team, all produced since July of 2011. Grant F. Smith tells us that while the contents have been withheld, their existence signals that the Pollard commutation request may be nearing a conclusion within the Obama administration. June 18th, says Smith, could mark the culmination of a massive lobbying campaign for release. Obama's dismal record on Israeli accountability says Pollard will soon walk free. Folks, take a look at that one, Why Obama Will Free Jonathan Pollard by Grant F. Smith, and also take a look at what Grant has posted at his own website in terms of all of these PDF files. Because there you will see not only what has been going on in these communications between the pardon attorney and Pollard's legal team, but you can see all of the things that pertain to yet another case, this one which Grant F. Smith writes about in the June-July 2012 Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. It's entitled, Stuart Nozette Sentenced to 13 Years for Attempted Mossad Espionage. It seems Mr. Nozette's Alliance for Competitive Technology, or ACT, loved to broker classified American secrets to the Israel Aerospace Industries. And after Mr. Nozette was sentenced to, quote, the least restrictive conditions possible, unquote, by Jewish U.S. District Court Judge Paul L. Friedman, a subsidiary of IAI, known as Elta Systems, announced it would soon open a 100-person operation in Maple Lawn, Maryland. Where are you, Ron and Rand Paul? Where are you, Mitt Romney, on this issue? And, of course, we learned from Grant F. Smith, in terms of what he has to say about Jonathan Pollard, is that there has been virtually no publicity over the fact that the Israeli front company Telegy was, in the summer of 2010, just 2 years ago, illegally shipping nuclear weapons components out of California to Israel. Folks, wake up and smell the flowers. We have a fifth column operating in this country. You know who they are. You know where their money is going. You know the Congress they have purchased. You know the White House they have purchased. You know the news media they control. We need say nothing more. Story number three today, Max Blumenthal, sir punch. We looked at this one last week. Romney's man on Iran. Romney's man on Iran, according to Max Blumenthal, is primarily Elliot Cohen. But we need to take a look at a gentleman by the name of Mitchell Rice. Mitchell Rice is another advisor, foreign policy advisor to Mitt Romney. If you take a look at what TPM Muckraker tells us today, Romney advisor Mitchell Rice backs terrorist group, quote-unquote, meaning the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, the subject of our conversation today, Dr. Foote, and with Ann Singleton. And Mitchell Rice jokes about being a potential criminal. I think we need to take the word potential out of that one, folks, and just say that he's flat a criminal, along with Ed Rendell, Rudolph Giuliani, Tom Ridge, General Peter Pace, Michael Mukasey, and all of the other Israeli agents that have been taking thousands of dollars from the MEK in order to promote their delisting as a terrorist organization, which they were, and I effectively argue still are. Ed Rendell, the last time we were looking at the MEK money sweepstakes, Zionist Jew, former mayor of Philadelphia, Ed Rendell, former mayor governor of Pennsylvania, Ed Rendell, a guy who loves to broker state of Pennsylvania homeland security business to Israeli intelligence fronts, leads with something like $160,000 in money received from the MEK, still listed by our State Department as a terror organization. Ed, congratulations. I'm sure to you and to your minions, $160,000 is just pocket change. And finally, story number four. MEK terrorist group tasks two battalions to stir unrest in Syria. This comes to us courtesy of the Habilian Association in Iran. According to the terrorist Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization, MEK, MKO, PMOI, or NCR, has tasked 400 terrorists with stirring unrest in Syria. According to Syed Mohammad Javad Ahsahminejad, the Secretary General of the Habilian Association, a human rights group formed of the families of 17,000 Iranian terror victims, the revelation was made by a highly trusted MKO veteran who used to serve the MKO or MEK ringleader Miriam Rajavi as her highly confided interpreter in top secret sessions with former Iraqi regime officials and U.S. authorities. Ahsahminejad said he had informed Syria of the MEK's meddling during a meeting with the Syrian ambassador to Tehran. The Secretary General of the Habilian Association had told the Syrian envoy late in May that the MEK-MKO is preparing itself to stage a massive terrorist operation in Syria. Again, folks, our toll-free number is 866-730-7514. That's 866-730-7514. The access code is 285-645-POUND. That's 285-645-POUND. Those who wish to participate via Skype may do so by using free conferencing .53881-1300 as the Skype contact. After calling that contact, bring up the dial pad or keypad and use access code 179164-POUND. And again, there is a chat room that's available to you if you're on the computer. That is www.1300.com. theuglytruth.wordpress.com. Once you're there, you will see the place simply to click on where it says chat room. All right, folks, here we go. Today's topic is the Mujahideen Iqaq, or MEK. We are joined by Dr. Paul Sheldon Foote of Cal State Fullerton University, member of Academics for Ron Paul, acknowledged international expert on the MEK, and also by Ann Singleton, presently residing in the UK, past member of the MEK, and past guest of the British Broadcasting Corporation in discussing this organization, its ideology, its methods, its cultic leadership. For further background, the MEK, see the numerous media appearances of both Dr. Paul Sheldon Foote and Ann Singleton through Google search, also the websites of the Hebelian Association, the Najat Society, and Iran Interlink, also, all of which can be found on my links page at markbancock.com. Also check out my own past article on the Raymond Tanter divorce case. Folks, if you think we're not in trouble in this country, take a look at some of the things and some of the allegations that surround that divorce case. The Raymond Tanter divorce case and the Iran Policy Committee, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and yes, the MEK, and yes, Israeli intelligence. Paul and Ann, how are you?
Good.
Good. I don't know who wants to go first. Paul, I guess we'll start with you and then go to Ann. What are your reactions, Paul, to the present situation going on with the MEK worldwide? Cover any angle that you wish, and where has all of this taken us?
The disturbing angle within the United States itself is the attempt to remove the MEK from the State Department terrorist list. And Ann can talk at great length about their success in doing that in European countries. But as you noted, the MEK has paid huge sums of money to very prominent Democrats and Republicans and former military leaders to either write, say, or travel around giving talks supporting this Rajavi cult or Pol Pot of Iran terrorist group.
Yes, and I guess to get into a little bit of history surrounding these guys, and of course both of you are the acknowledged experts on this, I'm just along for the ride, but this organization began, as I understand it, as a neo-Marxist leftist group in Pahlavi, Iran, back in the 1960s at the University of Tehran. For a period of years during the Pahlavi era, they were assassinating American defense contractors and American military personnel in that country during the Pahlavi years. Later, they would be involved in siding with the Saddam Hussein regime against Iran during the Iran-Iraq War of 8 years. And of course, they would be involved both in the distant past as well as right up to the present time in all kinds of acts of terror against the Iranian people and against their current government. We're talking bomb blasts, we're talking assassinations, we're talking about all kinds of things that clearly are demonstrably criminal, and yet, Paul, it seems like the United States and Israel don't really have a problem with this. Why is that?
Well, I'm delighted that you mentioned the year they started. That was under the Shah of Iran, and their purpose was to overthrow the Shah of Iran. This is something that you don't see mentioned very much in the press anymore because they want to leave the impression that the group was started to overthrow the current government of Iran, and that's a total lie. Another thing to add about the Mujahideen Iqaq is that Masoud Rajavi was a very well-read reader of communist literature from throughout the world. Unlike the communist Tudeh party of Iran, which was a pro-Stalin party and did not do well in Iran, the reason that Masoud Rajavi was much more successful both in Iran and around the world is he used a liberation theology approach where you blend Marxist ideas with local religions such as Islam or in Latin America with Christianity. Or in this country with a famous church in Chicago, I guess, right? So
yes, that's right. You have a sarcastic wit, Dr. Foote, but go ahead.
Basically, there has been no truth being said in the Western media about these folks. They're not pro-democracy. Ann can tell better than I can about the supposed election of Mariam Rajavi in France with, in the presence of a few hundred MEK members. They have almost zero support in Iran. Even the New York Times magazine in June of 2003 had an article called The Cult of Rajavi, which Ann has posted at her website, iraninterlink.org, which they conclude, you know, this is the first time I've ever seen in the history of the New York Times not favorable to a communist organization.
Yes.
this is how nutty these people are. They are truly a cult. Anne has written at least two books explaining in massive detail the cult aspects, and I'd like to just back out and let her explain that, especially the freedom dances, but the massive mandatory divorces. Anne can do a far better job than I can.
Well, let's bring Anne Singleton in at this point. Anne, you and I have had one other radio conversation quite a while ago when I was with the previous network. I have seen your past work with the BBC, and just in short, share with us how you came to be involved with the MEK, all of the things that you have experienced with these people, and why through your work at iraninterlink.org and elsewhere, you've now been working overtime to expose them and to basically bring the truth about these folks to the world.
Sure. Well, thanks for inviting me on the program. As you and Paul have explained very well, the Mujahideen started under the Pahlavi regime, and it started as an anti-imperialist armed struggle group. When I got to know them, I was at university, and I was recruited by Iranian students who were involved in the events of the 1979 revolution.
Being recruited?
Recruited, yeah. Because the Mujahideen undertook a massive recruitment program.
Yes.
To try to swell their ranks. They had popular support at that time because, of course, people took sides quite clearly. But they soon kind of trashed their own reputation, as it were, by engaging in armed struggle and basically went on to kill many, many civilians and have had no other way of operating except through violence and terrorism and assassinations. When I joined them, they were supported by most of the Western governments who opposed the dictatorship of the mullahs in Iran. And so I had no real reason to see them as being a very dangerous or bad group. When my own government was supporting them, you know, why would I feel that they were a danger or a threat to me? I had to learn out the hard way, unfortunately, by being with them for around 20 years. And in that time, they became more and more and more cult-like, which meant that they exerted more and more control over people like myself, the ordinary members. When I left them, I would only describe my experience of being with the Mujahideen as being enslaved. I was actually a slave to the Rajavis. I think probably a better word than slave would be a gladiator, because you are required, of course, to fight. And then, you know, getting back to the terrorism list in America and Europe, what I think needs to be clarified is that when they were removed from the terrorism list in Europe, they were removed on a technicality, the legal technicality. It wasn't actually because a decision had been made by Western governments, European governments, that they were not involved in terrorism or that they were not a terrorist organization. I think all European governments would be clear that they regard the Mujahideen as a terrorist entity, with the current potential to commit terrorist acts. If they're not on the list here, it's only because of the legal situation. And as Paul has hinted, you know, they have thrown so much money at this issue that you only have to stand and in awe of how they've got hold of this money. Where is it all coming from?
Where do you think it's coming from? Mark Lennon and I have discussed this on the air, trying to get to the bottom of this. How does this, if you might pardon the expression, this ragtag so-called Islamic Marxist terror organization run like a religious cult by the Rajavis, how do they come into the kind of money that has them bankrolling people like Rudolph Giuliani, Tom Ridge, Ed Rendell, Michael Mukasey, and so forth and so on? Are they simply obtaining money and spending money that is being obtained from Western banking interests in Israel? Is that what we're to conclude from this?
Well, it's interesting now that the American media and political world is focusing attention on this issue, that people are actually getting paid large sums of money for supporting a group which is on the American terrorism list. You know, there's a spotlight being shone on the MEK finances. What I can tell you for sure is that since the MEK, the Mujahideen, were based in Iraq first, back in 1983, they moved there, they have been paid millions and millions and millions of dollars by Saddam Hussein, by Saudi Arabia, and by Zionist interests. We can see the pinpoint Israel in particular, but by Zionist interests. And basically, Masoud Rajavi, the leader of the Mujahideen, has run several companies, invested this money in his own name, in his own accounts, or in companies in trusted people's names. And they are now living on this money, these investments. And so this money is actually coming from MEK companies and investments, and brought into the US to fund their propaganda campaigns. So quite simply, yes, they are, in a sense, foreign terrorist group, if you like.
Are we to understand from this, and I'm addressing this to either one of you or both of you, are we to understand from this, then, that as far as the money that the MEK receives for its various nefarious activities, that here we have perhaps a unique confluence of Zionist Israeli interests, American banking and oil interests, and then Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states are also playing a role in this because of the fact that they have their own animosities toward Iran? Is that what's going on here?
I'll do it briefly and let you do a lot more of. I had the great pleasure of meeting Anne a few years ago and her husband, Nasser Fatabande, in London. And he told me his story, his personal experience in Iraq, where he supervised some MEK people in removing the Saudi insignia from gold bars, that the Saudis were shipping gold bars and giving gifts to these people on the condition they would hide the source of it. In this country, we have massive political corruption in the form of what are called public charities. There are more than 1.7 million public charities in this country. Americans who contribute money to these organizations are able to take tax deductions. They even include charities for illegal settlements in Israel. But the poor Muslims who started these kind of charities, such as the Holy Land Foundation, are in jail. These organizations are supposed to file with the government every year a Form 990, but what they don't have to make public is the Schedule B, which shows the sources of their money. They only have to show how they use their money. Now, when I ran for public office in this country, I had to show every source $100 and more, and I was totally prohibited as a candidate to taking even 1 cent from any foreign source. And yet in this country we have more than 1.7 million of these public charities. They can get money from anywhere, from the CIA, from any foreign source. We won't know. It's hidden. And it's and both parties support this. It's the reason for the massive political corruption in this country.
Well, yes, and just to put people on to how bad this is, there are all kinds of articles on this on the net. Glenn Greenwald's recent story at Salon, salon.com, titled Washington's High-Powered Terrorist Supporters, will give people a most disgusting list of quote-unquote American patriots involved in taking money from these people. We're talking Fran Townsend, Rudolph Giuliani, Howard Dean, Michael Mukasey, Ed Rendell, Andy Card, Lee Hamilton, Tom Ridge, Bill Richardson, Wesley Clark, Michael Hayden, John Bolton, Louis Free, as well as General Pace, others. This is quite a list, folks. And are we to infer from this that all of these guys are taking this cash, not simply because cash is nice, with the exception of Mark Glenn and Mark Dankoff, everybody has cash, right? But that in effect, it's because Israel wants this and Israel is using the MEK. Is that why these guys have gotten the green light and a free pass to be taking money from what is still officially listed by the State Department as a terrorist organization? What do you think about this, either one of you?
Well, I would give it this context, but as I said earlier, when I joined the Mujahideen, when I was first active with them back in the early 1980s, I don't think you'd find a single politician in the West who didn't support them. But as the Mujahideen have become more and more dirty, then this real political support has fallen away by people who don't want to get dirty by association. What you have left now are people who are not afraid of getting dirty by association. And they, as I said, Donald Rumsfeld jumped into Saddam Hussein's jack boots when he supported the Mujahideen in Iraq by giving them protected, falsely giving them protected person status back in 2004. So the people that you see supporting the Mujahideen now are supporting them because they would have done it the last 30 years anyway. But now they're having to get paid because the price has gone up basically. They can now charge what they like and the Mujahideen are so desperate, they are really on their knees at this moment. So they're prepared to pay anybody and everybody what they can to come and support them.
Yes.
In addition, Mark, I'd like to add France to this conversation.
Sure.
The current headquarters of the leaders is in France. France was also where Ayatollah Khomeini waited out his years before returning to Iran. So these countries like to keep an inventory, and England's another good example, but France and England like to keep an inventory of future leaders to impose on other countries.
Sorry, I was just going to claim London as the home for heads of terrorist organizations. So,
well, we'll say Paris and London are running neck and neck. How about that, Anne? That'll work. It'll work, sure. One and two, photo finish at the tape. In terms of the MEK, Paul and Anne, what are we to make of some of the statements being made by Reza Pahlavi in the past that seem to be very forthcoming toward the MEK? I mean, after all, they were very much a part of the coalition of red and black that overthrew his father in 1979. Now Reza Pahlavi seems to be suggesting, Paul, that he and his monarchist movement can do business with these people. Untangle that just for a moment.
This was untangled a few years ago by Connie Bruck in an article about the crazy antics of Reza Pahlavi and the other who want to be placed by America in charge of Iran, sort of like a Hollywood casting call. Interestingly enough, about 6 years ago, Reza Pahlavi announced he was going to hold an international conference in America of all Iranian opposition to come under his umbrella organization. And he even invited the Iranian communist terrorists, the Mujahideen Khalq. And they said, nonsense, you're invited to join our organization. We have the National Council of Resistance of Iran. We are the legitimate umbrella group. So apparently their umbrellas were too big for each other, and they couldn't get under either one.
But, you know, it's interesting. Let's take a look at that for a minute. Paris, France. Now, I know that a few years ago, a prominent member of the Iranian monarchist community in Los Angeles told me that she had been invited to a conference in Paris that involved various factions in the worldwide Iranian monarchist movement, that there was an American journalist that was very much involved in trying to put this conference together, a journalist about whom many allegations have been made in terms of connections to the Israeli Mossad, and that this monarchist group that was meeting in Paris was in fact unofficially going to be holding out an olive branch to the Rajavis and to the MEK in trying to put together a wider anti-Mullah coalition. Is that still what you suspect is going on here, Paul? And what credibility can the Iranian monarchist movement have left if they're doing business with the MEK? I mean, this seems to me to be a contradiction in terms, especially not just on an ideological basis, but aside from whatever the monarchist disagreements are with the present regime in Iran, surely these people can't be endorsing acts of mass murder directed at Iranians in these different provinces of that country. And surely, at least a few people in the monarchist movement ought to be thinking better of being a part of an Israeli-launched attack on Iran that would at least potentially destroy Iranian interests and the Iranian nation state as it's been known up to this point, and thousands, potentially even millions of Iranians could be killed. I have a little bit of difficulty unpacking this. What do you think is in their minds?
They are some of the most dishonest people around, and there's a lot of competition for that title, but I was in Tehran in the summer of 1976, and one night I was in my wife's home, and the television was on, and they interrupted regular television programming because the Shah wanted to address the nation. And so I listened, and he said, my brothers and sisters, we're all brothers and sisters, we only need one political party. He abolished all political parties and created a new one called Rastakriz, or the Resurgence Party. And he established totalitarian rule in Iran and brought himself down. I told my wife's relatives at that moment, I said, he just killed himself. And he looked at me like I was crazy. I said, he's going to be out of power in a few years. And 3 years later, he was gone. The American government doesn't, and media don't like to talk about this fact that this man, who supposedly was our representative of Western democracy in the Middle East, or as Jimmy Carter called it, the shining island of the Middle East, of stability, actually destroyed himself. And I had another interesting experience a few years ago with my Yahoo group, Traders USA, where a monarchist had sent me two photographs. One showed the cabinet under the Shah and the monarchists, another one the current cabinet, and said, look at all these people under the current government. They don't match the people that the Shah had in his cabinet. And I responded to him and sent a copy of my response to Fereydoon Hoveyda and said, what do you think of this? One of the ones included in the photograph was Hoveyda, who was the top man in the Shah's government, who was thrown into jail by the Shah on charges of corruption. And then when the revolution came, the poor man was in jail and was executed with the takeover. And unfortunately, Fereydoon said, I'm in very ill health, If I live long enough, I will write a book exposing the monarchists. Unfortunately, he died shortly thereafter. But the monarchists are extremely despicable people. I see them in Southern California in large numbers. They hang around nightclubs, and they're of no use, but they lie like crazy.
Yes, and it reminds me, Amir Abbas Hoveyda's brother, the late Feridun Hoveyda, who was Iran's ambassador to the UN in the Pahlavi years, Ambassador Hoveyda told me in his home in Virginia before his death a number of years ago that he had no use for Shah Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, and that he had betrayed, as far as Feridun Hoveyda was concerned, had betrayed Feridun's brother, Amir Abbas, had betrayed many other people. And in Feridun Hoveyda's words to me, which he stated on the record for an interview that was subsequently published, he saw the Shah as, quote, a captain who failed to go down with his ship and got out of Dodge, unquote. Sounds like he would pretty much agree with that assessment.
I would. He was a very weak person. The American ambassadors described him as very confused and indecisive. And he was under a lot of stupid pressure, too. Let's blame the Americans. You know about this clash of civilizations and Professor Huntington. Well, the idea of closing the political parties in Iran and creating a totalitarian rule did not come from the Shah. It came straight from America in these clash of civilization totalitarians we have in this country.
Yes, absolutely, and this is now what we're left with. I'm curious, in terms of what attracted you to the MEK, share a little bit with our listeners as to what their appeal was to you as a younger person in the beginning. Talk a little bit about your progressive realization that this was not something that you wanted to be involved with. And give our listeners something in the way of insight as to the totalitarian methods used by the top leadership of the MEK and what most people, reasonable people, would term brainwashing. It kind of reminds me of the stuff that the psychologist Robert J. List has written about in bygone decades about totalitarian cultic mind control and the erasure of memory, taking over of will, the institution of these absolutist authority figures. Share with us what the business of the Rajavis and their MEK cult is really like if you're on the inside.
Sure. Well, you're bringing up Jay Lipton is totally relevant. Anyone who wants to understand the Mujahideen in its current form can do no better than, or do no worse than, reading up on cults and cultic behavior. When I was first attracted to the Mujahideen, I saw them, of course, as a political organisation, and as I say, it was at the time of the revolution. In the UK, at that time, in the 70s, we had had a lot of political upheaval, we'd had a lot of strikes and labour disputes, and so there was a lot of kind of, let me call it politicising. There were many active leftist groups, right-wing groups, there was a lot of extremes in British politics. And so when the Mujahideen came along into the university campuses, there was a kind of atmosphere at that time of people looking for political niches and homes to kind of pursue their own ideas. The thing with the Mujahideen was that they were kind of unique in a sense, that they were extremely professional in their political activities and their recruitment and their fundraising activities, much more so than other dissident groups from other countries on university campuses. They really went about their opposition and activities with professionality, to the point where they required their supporters to leave their studies and jobs and things and actually take up full-time activism, which is eventually what I did. They, over the years, used their, what I would call, recruitment techniques, which are standard cult recruitment techniques with the nut bombing and the approval of the person and then flattery and such like to make you feel that you are really special person and that the only place that you can fulfill your potential as this special person is inside the Mujahideen itself, which of course would be elevated to being this extremely unique and sophisticated higher order organization. From the start, they never saw themselves as just an ordinary group. They saw themselves as the saviors of the world. And that's really how they indoctrinated the membership as well. I think in essence, the Mujahideen, like any cult, operates through two main ways. It operates through fear and through deception. So being a member of such an organization, you are kept completely deceived. They completely will censor your sources of information. And interestingly, where they cannot censor that information, for example, the people you have in the United States who are Mujahideen members are of course exposed to, you know, the media and society, and they live with ordinary people on a day-to-day basis. But what the Mujahideen have done is to use fear and what you call cultic phobias to make a sort of mental prison for the members. So that when you start to look around yourself at society, you are looking at it from a position of, first of all, this great superiority, where you feel that you are a sort of higher party, sort of kind of person than ordinary people. But you're also looking at society with fear, because you fear that you'll be corrupted, or that the Iranian regime will come and get you, or you have a whole host of fears indoctrinated into your head, so that you actually refuse to think and refuse to acknowledge the outside world. You almost imprison and police yourself in your own mind. And as I say, I was with them for 20 years, and so I kind of imbibes all this indoctrination, and it's done it in a very systematic way on a daily basis. There's a kind of daily confessions of your sins and your bad thoughts and your inability to obey the leader. And one of the reasons I left, is because they have imposed these divorces on the membership, so that nobody in the organization was able to stay with their spouse or their kids. They had all the children evacuated. And also, if you weren't married, which I wasn't at the time, you had to somehow mentally and emotionally divorce from any possibility of being married or having a partnership or relationship. And for me, this was really kind of counter to what I saw for myself, you know, as being part, you know, what I would do with my life. I never thought I wouldn't get married. And so I kind of dropped out of the Mujahideen because I felt I had failed this requirement. It was only after I left that I turned around and kind of thought more carefully about my experience and did the research and found Jay Lifton and Margaret Singer and the other cult experts. And it was just, you know, one of those light bulb moments where you think, oh no, it was a cult, I was in a cult for 20 years. And from that point, I have to say that I went from being a victim of the Rajavis, which, as we know, there are still 3,500 people in Iraq are still victims of the Rajavis. But I went from being a victim to being a survivor. And for being a survivor, I started to become more and more active in exposing the Mujahideen, not for what it said it is, which is some kind of democratic feminist opposition group, but what it really, really is a dangerous and destructive mind control cult which uses terrorism and violence as its modus operandi.
Yes, and which may well end up being used by the Israeli Mossad and Benjamin Netanyahu and the American neoconservatives in the United States to begin a wider war with Iran that, in the judgment of many of us, has all of the potential to mushroom, folks, into World War III. We need to keep an eye on this very, very closely. Again, for our listeners, you can get to us chat room at www.theuglytruth.wordpress.com. Click on chat room there. We wish to greet our listeners in the United States, the UK, Ireland, Czechoslovakia, Switzerland, Spain, Canada, the Netherlands, Italy, and Lebanon thus far. Our toll-free call-in number is 866-730-7514. That's 866-730-7514. The access code is 28545#. That's 28546-45#. Those who wish to participate via Skype may do so by calling freeconferencing.530-881-1300. Use that as a Skype contact. After calling that contact, use access code 179164# with your dial plan. We have a caller. It is none other than the infamous Mark Glenn calling from Coeur d'Alene. Mark, you are on the air. Go ahead, sir.
Fantastic program, extremely interesting. And Mark, I just wanted to ask Ann and Dr. Foote regarding the last comment that you made regarding the MEK and why there is this push by these powerful people to have this group delisted as a terrorist organization. Now, you know, you listed some of these people, Mark, and these are not what we would call low-level politicos. I mean, these are people who have spent their entire lives building up their political fortunes, and they wouldn't be sticking their neck out by blatantly violating U.S. law with regards to material support of terrorism unless they knew that, that the fix was in and that nothing was going to happen to them by doing this. But more troubling than that, and what concerns me, is what you just said a moment ago as to why there is this push to get this group delisted. Now, as many of you know, in the aftermath of 9/11, given the fact that the only arrests that took place on that morning were five Israeli intelligence officers who were in a very conspicuous position where they could view the towers coming down and they were seen cheering and all the rest of that, as a result of this, no doubt Israel is having a very tough time these days in being able to get her agents in and out of places in the West and being able to operate with the kinds of freedom that they did in the past, because they're no doubt being watched by certain, you know, intelligence agencies and whatnot. And so in that regard, the MEK would be a perfect group for Israel to use in carrying out a terrorist act all over the world. Now, we know for a fact that they have been doing it in Iran. They have been the ones principally responsible for assassinating these Iranian scientists. But what concerns me is that these people, I mean, let's face it, if they were willing to kill as many as 17,000 of their own people, okay, what would they be willing to do to Americans? You know, are these the kinds of people who would carry out an order to go into a school and gun down a bunch of kids, or into a shopping mall and to kill a bunch of innocent people? And of course, if they were caught and arrested, they have Iranian names, they speak Farsi, and all they have to do is claim that they are doing this at the behest of the regime in power now, and then next thing you know, the United States is at war with Iran. So I'd like to hear both Dr. Foote's comments on this and Ann's comments, and I'll listen off the air. Thank you very much.
And let me add one thing to what Mark Glenn has said, and then you guys go ahead. Cy Hirsch of The New Yorker, of course, has written an expose showing that the MEK has had people in this country being trained by the United States Central Command at a secret location in Nevada. That, in conjunction with what Mark was just suggesting, Paul and Ann, what are we to make of this?
Well, Seymour Hersh has also written about the use by America's Special Operation Forces of the MEK inside Iran doing terrorist acts. So you have all these highly paid, prominent politicians claiming they're not a terrorist organization. All you have to do is watch the Fox News channel, and they frequently are bragging about it, saying, we have boots on the ground today in Iran. When under President George W. Bush, Colin Powell closed down the MEK's office, the National Council of Resistance of Iran, in the National Press Building, where they've been operating for more than 10 years. Well, they needed employment. Well, the head of the office was immediately given a job at the Fox News Channel as a foreign affairs analyst. So here you have people claiming to be anti-communist, claiming to be Republicans or conservatives, who are so stupid they don't even know when they hear one talking to them. They have desperately needed places to make more legitimacy, as Mark suggested. Azerbaijan has been one of the places that's recently been willing to take large numbers of them.
That's not going to happen. Sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead, Ann.
Sure, that's not going to happen. I think there's a tendency to kind of big up the Mujahideen because of their own publicity, of course. Yes, they have been implicated in the assassinations of the Iranian scientists, and yes, they will be used as an assassination force as much as possible, but the Mujahideen itself is practically finished in Iraq. The Camp Ashraf, which has been the stronghold of the Mujahideen for the last 30 years, is now being relocated, and the people who are coming out of there, you can see quite clearly that they are old, they're sick, they are not a fighting force. Most of them are older than me, and I'm 53 for heaven's sake, so how these people would be expected to go and fight to create regime change in Iran is anybody's guess. And there's always been a big question, is why would the Israelis be so kind of dumb to back such a group who actually will not be able to fulfill any activity. The Mujahideen do not have any presence inside Iran at all. When they do the assassinations, and they were also involved in the protests in the 2009 post-election protests, they actually have to ship people in. They have to send people into Iran to perform these acts. So first of all, in terms of, you know, they're being capable of overthrowing the regime and doing what they say they'll do, that's just not going to happen. The people who, they're mainly a small group of them sort of creamed off, and as Seymour Hersh has pointed out, you know, trained for special ops and such like. But they really are a finished force. They really are on their back legs. I mean, Marion Rajah was in court in France a few days back. The French are pursuing their case against her. It hasn't gone away. It won't go away. You know, I don't really see that the Mujahideen are going to be part of this push for war. It's worse. If anything, they are being used to maintain this kind of enmity between Iran and Israel.
And I guess what Mark Glenn was driving at, and this gets into what Glenn Greenwald was talking about at Salon as well, we have NBC News all but confirming that the Mujahideen-e-Khalq assassinated these Iranian nuclear scientists, five or six of them in the last couple of years, at the behest of the Israeli Mossad intelligence organization. I guess what Mark is suggesting is that in conjunction with Cy Hirsch's piece, that the United States Central Command has actually been providing paramilitary training for the MEK at several secret American bases in this country, that the fear among many of us is, Mark Glenn included, that the MEK could be used in the continental United States by Israel to undertake false flag operation that would be falsely blamed on the regime in Tehran in order to give Benjamin Netanyahu and his minions in Congress and in the Israeli lobby in the United States the casus belli that they need to get the United States involved in a war that up to now the American people are getting increasingly sick of hearing about, especially when it comes to suggesting that there's going to be a wider American role in this. That, I think, is where Mark is coming from. Do you see any possibility of that?
Well, in terms of how dirty things can get, that's certainly a possibility. As I say, the Zionist interests will cream off the people that they can use from the MEK, and yes, if that's their dirty tactic, that they're going to use the false flag operation, you know, how desperate they will get depends on how much resistance there is to provoking a war. You know, they will probably push it to the limit, why wouldn't they? They've invested so heavily in this path, in this way of behaving, that, you know, they would really want to see their money back at some point, which means regime change, of course.
Yes. What do each of you make of this report by the Secretary for the Hibbilian Association, which again is a human rights group in Iran? It's formed of the families of the 17,000 Iranian terror victims, victims of the MEK. And the Secretary General of the Hibbilian Association indicates that 400 terrorists affiliated with the MEK have been tasked with stirring unrest in Syria. What do either of you know about this, or what have you heard about it?
I've heard sort of a story that it may be true, it may not be true, but that really defines the use of the Mujahideen. It is not an indigenous Iranian opposition group at all. It is a mercenary force. Its leader, Masoud Rajavi, will and has sell his members to anybody for any purpose, as long as he can stay in control of the group and as long as he can actually stay alive. I mean, that's his bottom line at this present time. So, yes, he's perfectly capable of selling his grandmother and grandfather to anybody to perform any acts of violence. You know, what people need to just get clear about the Mujahideen is, no matter if they're on a terrorist list or not on a terrorist list, makes absolutely no material difference to them whatsoever. Their unique selling point is that they are prepared to use violence, they're prepared to die for what they are fighting for or against. They are a brainwashed force who will obey orders, and they have nothing to live for, so they are quite a suicidal force. From that point of view, they are useful for the kind of people who want to use the mercenaries to push their agendas, whether in Syria or in Iran or Iraq, or in the USA, as you're saying. The Mujahideen leader has no hesitation in sending his people to perform any act of violence.
So what maybe we're dealing with here, as I'm trying to process all this in my own mind, is a situation then, Anne and Paul, where perhaps the grassroots membership of the MEK is simply psychically devoted to the absolute will of the Rajavis. The Rajavis, in turn, are perfectly willing to sell themselves to the highest bidder. And it certainly appears to me that right now the highest bidder is Israel and the United States and Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Cooperation States, Gulf Cooperation Council states, all of which have their own reasons for aiming their sabers at Iran. Am I interpreting this correctly or not?
Well, go ahead, Ian.
Yeah, I just interject here because I really want to make it clear that yes, you're right, but the number of the people over whom gradually have control has dwindled to very, very few. The people who are in Camp Ashraf and Camp Liberty, where they've just been moving under UNAMI's direction, the majority of those people are no longer loyal to Rajavi. I would say that, you know, 80 or 90% of them would willingly leave if they were able. The people we're talking about, the devoted members, are less than 10% of the organization.
What does that translate into in terms of numbers, Anne, in terms of 10% of...
3,500.
So we're 10% of 2,500?
3,500.
3,500, okay. So we're talking about 10% of that, a relatively small cadre of people, presumably whose chief use any intelligence agency, state intelligence agency, or outside foreign power would be as a small but highly effective and trained paramilitary force to be divvied up for all kinds of black operational purposes then.
I mean, I can't say what strange powers will make use of them for, and how they'll make use of them. I mean, my concern really, I work with the Iraqi government, and my concern is that there are, say, 3,000 people in Iraq who really need to be rescued from this situation, where they're being horribly exploited and treated cruelly. You know, and I think the United States is not playing it's not playing fair on this issue at all, because they have been using this group for 30 years, and it really is time that they kind of stepped in and ended it and came to the rescue of these victims.
Well, are we, however, to look at the money trail, look at these highly placed American political figures with clear links to Israel and the Israeli lobby, and figure that not only is the United States not going to do the right thing in terms of rescuing those who have been victimized by the MEK from within, but that in fact those who wish to have the MEK delisted as a terror organization by the State Department will be ultimately successful. Paul and Ann, what do you think of that? Do you think that the delisting effort will win? Do you think it'll lose, or it'll be on the back burner for a while? What's your feeling on this?
Well, as Ann, I think, has already suggested, whether they're on the list or not, doesn't matter in the sense that they will be used as terrorists for those who are able. I mean, Carlos Ajaco and many others had extremely small groups of terrorist groups that were paid huge sums of money to go in and do their nasty work in that region. This is a very large terror, even if they only have 350 young ones. And Ann can certainly tell the story about when they were much younger at the end of the Iran-Iraq war, and marched into Iran, having been told by the Rajavis that they wouldn't have to fire a single shot because the Iranian people would march with them a million strong into Tehran and take over. So, I mean, that's in their heyday.
Yes. Yes, absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. Any final thoughts from either of you on anything related to the MEK? Ann and Paul, have any upcoming travels to Iran scheduled the next year or two? What are you going to be doing in your various activities on behalf of exposure of this organization?
From my side, I would dearly love to get back to Iraq. I don't think I will get back until the autumn, but I really... would like to get back there and keep putting pressure on the people there to kind of sort out the situation. When I say the people there, I mean UNAMI and the US and the European Union representatives there. They really are not kind of getting to grips with the problem as much as I would like. So, yeah, that's what I'd like to do in the next few months.
Well, I would like to thank you for being on the show and to commend to people what I think is still online in terms of your work with the British Broadcasting Corporation in discussing this whole business of the MEK, that television show, and then your past work with me on the radio when I was on the Republic Broadcasting Network has gone a long way toward educating all of us, including me, on this whole subject of the MEK and their methods. And I want to commend to our listeners Ann Singleton's website, IranInterlink.org. And if you happen to forget that, folks, just go to markdankoff.com, go to my links page, and you will find IranInterlink.org. You will also find the websites of the Hibillion Association and the Najat Society to gain all of the historical perspective, all of the inside information, and coverage in all the present activities of the MEK, including their attempt at being delisted in the United States. Paul Sheldon Foote, I'd like to thank you for being on as well, and your appearances on Press TV Iran are absolutely wonderful. Tell us now, Dr. Foote, with your great crystal ball there at Cal State Fullerton, what does a good, sound, free market, non-interventionist, non-militarist, anti-Zionist conservative do all elections? I'll give you 100 words or less. Go ahead, Paul.
Vote third party.
Well, one option might be Merlin Miller. One option might be the Libertarian candidate. I don't know who they're going to be putting up. If I might put you on the spot, Paul, do you think you'll vote Libertarian this year or what?
I don't. I got burned last time. Bob Barr was the candidate last time, and he recently posted his statement of support for the Mujahideen Khalq.
Yes, I remember that vividly. You and I talked about it at the time. I'll leave my listeners, before I do my final show summary here, with a big thank you both to Dr. Paul Sheldon Foote and to Ann Singleton, and also to say, folks, I want you to text me. I want you to call me. I want you to send email about whether or not you want me to run for the presidency of the United States. And whether you want me to run or not, I leave you with one promise. I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. But God bless all the people that are going to try this time around in third-party political forays in the United States. This is going to be a good year for a legitimate third-party candidate to run, based upon the fact that our so-called alternatives, our so-called choices, are Barack, I am a Zionist, Obama, and Mitt, I am a super Zionist, honest folks, Romney. This is where it is. And when we get back to today's topic, Mujahideen Khalq, again, when we see the larger implications of what the MEK is and who is presently using them, we get back to such things as Mitt Romney, and why Obama will free Jonathan Pollard, why Stuart Nozette was sentenced to an absolute joke of a criminal sentence after trading away American defense secrets to Israel for the umpteenth time. We get into the bigger picture of Mitt Romney on Iran and who Elliot Cohen and Mitchell Rice really are. And then, of course, we speak about Syria, and the fact that Syria is clearly the latest game plan for NATO and for the United States and for the Zionist entity in intervening in the Middle East and in Central Asia in a way that isolates Iran and, in my view, dangerously sets the stage for what could prove to be the next phase of this horrible business that's been going on since 2001. And that is a totally unjustifiable, illegitimate, illegal, an immoral preemptive military strike on Iran, courtesy of Benjamin Netanyahu and courtesy of the Zionist-occupied territory known as Capitol Hill and the White House. And folks, we get right back to this whole business of the MEK. Glenn Greenwald of Salon really brings it all together for us, I think, in talking about Israel. Israel as being, by definition, a state sponsor of terrorism. Leaving everything else aside, says Glenn Greenwald, if Israel, as NBC reports, has, quote, financed, trained, and armed, unquote, a group officially designated by the U.S. government as a terrorist organization, meaning the Mujahideen Khalq, isn't that the definitive act of how one becomes an official state sponsor of terrorism, quote, unquote? Amazingly, says Greenwald, as Daniel Larison notes, One of the people who most vocally attacked Greenwald for labeling the murder of Iranian scientists as terrorism and for generally arguing that terrorism, quote-unquote, is a meaningless, cynically applied term, yesterday issued a justification for why Israel should be working with terrorist groups like the MEK. As Daniel Larison wrote about Tobin's article, Jonathan Tobin's article and commentary, quote, in other words, Israeli state sponsorship of a terrorist organization is acceptable because it's in a good cause. Because Israel is overreacting to a perceived threat from Iran, Tobin believes that it's entirely defensible for Israel to partner with a recognized terrorist group. In other words, Jonathan Tobin of commentary believes that terrorism is quote-unquote entirely defensible as long as it is committed by the right people and directed at the right targets. Folks, this is moral insanity, it's political insanity, it's sand, it's disaster. It is futuristic disaster for the United States of America if we continue to go down this pathway. That's it for Mark Dankos America Today, coming to you live from San Antonio, Texas. Just a reminder that Jonathan Azaziah tomorrow will be on The Ugly Truth. Jonathan had a great appearance today on Channel Islam International in Johannesburg, where he discussed Pakistan. Catch that one, too, when it gets posted. Jonathan Azaziah again tomorrow, Ugly Truth. He was on today on Channel Islam International out of Johannesburg, where he discussed Pakistan. And I, Mark Dankos, will be back with you 1 week today on The Ugly Truth. God bless you. See you then.